Everybody loves chalupas. Everybody wants them now. If you ever want chalupas, I'm the one to tell you how. You got some chalupas. They're delicious and fresh. You want the chalupas, so get them off your chest. Hello, this is Rish Outfield, and I think this is the last time I'm going to do that chalupa bit at the beginning of an episode. I'm recording this at the very end of a year in which I'd say like one out of three episodes I put out, I did a little song, a variation on that chalupa Dale Next Exit song. And I never heard a single person say, "Boy, Rish, I sure loved your little chalupa songs. Please do more." I think I probably beat that into the ground. And you know, to be honest, it may be only me that was delighted and entertained by the word chalupa. I have to have told that story on the Chalupa Dale episode where my roommate's younger brother had heard this filthy Spanish slang word and he went, "Chalupa." And I was just like, "Oh my Lord, that has got to be the dirtiest word in the Spanish language or English language, frankly." And then when suddenly Taco Bell started having them, I was just like, "Whoa, can you say that? Holy smoke, all the Hispanics in the viewing audience are freaking out right now." Maybe I didn't tell this story, but it's just that word has always had a hilarious connotation to me, and it's childish, and I plan to stop. But, you know, the Rish Outcast is childish. And at this moment in time, I don't have any plans to stop. But don't support me on Patreon. Don't send me words of encouragement or give positive feedback. And you know, they might. There's only so much gas in the tank. Let's see, what was I saying just a second ago? There was something that I said where I was like, "Oh, I'll use that as a springboard, kids." Kids, okay. I was saying that it was childish. And that brings us to the story presentation that I'm going to do today. Now, for you, it is 2019, unless I'm really slow in delivering this story. For me, it's the end of 2018, and at the end of the year, you tend to think about the year that has passed, the months that are gone, the calendar that you're throwing away, and what you accomplished or what you failed to accomplish. And today was really gray and dismal, and the sun went down at about 4:30 p.m. And I felt a little bit morose about it. And it's funny because Big Anklevich, he didn't call me, I called him, but he's down in Houston, and he said, "Boy, it's kind of a mud..." What was the word he used? I don't think he uses the word muggy. I'm not sure if that's even a word. "It's sort of just like an overcast, ugly day down here," he said. And I have to admit that I am feeling a little bit blue, because I had explained to him that, you know, when it rains or when the sun is covered by clouds, sometimes I get melancholy for no reason. So it's a 1-2 punch of end of the year and then grayness and dark. And the silver lining is that where you are, it might not be dark yet. It might not be the end of the year. It might not be cold. It might be a heck of a nice sunny day out there, and you can go out and take advantage, and that's kind of neat. And it's not even a new year for you. The year is, geez, half over. How is April? But again, yes, childish, that's the word I was going back to. I tend to write a lot of stories that have a geriatric protagonist, a phrase that is forever linked to that episode that I just couldn't get out in 2018, I had to postpone 3 times, I think. So that's kind of soured me. Or a teen or a child protagonist. And you know, I write some teen stuff from time to time. But what I really like to write is old people and kids. And a lot of times it's a story about a grandparent or a grandparent-like figure and a grandchild or a grandchild-like figure. It's just something that appeals to me. I'm not sure why. And today we're going to get a story that is... That weird sound was me trying to think of what to say about the story. Whether I say, you know, that it's not good, or that it should be lost, or that, you know, I don't even have any idea why I'm doing an episode about it. But the story is called Friends in Paradise. It was written for the Horror Addicts Story Contest. Was it Masters of Horror? Gosh, I don't know what it was called anymore. I have done 2 episodes on the Rish Outcast of stories that I wrote for that contest. I believe that I did it 4 times, but maybe it was 5 times. And they would give you the overall theme of this year's contest, and then they give you 3 elements seemingly at random that you had to include in this story. And this was the very first one that I ever sent in, that I ever entered. And the thing about the Horror Addicts podcast is, for some reason, last I checked, and I could be wrong, but last I checked, the archive episodes were no longer available. You could no longer hear the 4 or 5 stories that I had sent them. So, they were essentially lost. I had recorded each one of them, edited them all myself, and sent them in, and they all aired on their podcast. And then, after a while, I guess they just disappeared. And I don't know, there must be 100 different factors, possible factors for something like that. But once I had sent in the story, I didn't have the file anymore. With the exception of, I want to say that it was like Little Miss Fortune was the name of that story. And gosh, that's pretty clever. It's like saying Little Miss Fortune or Little Miss Fortune. That one I still had the audio from. And if I recall, that one was the one that I won the contest with. And that was the first time when they said, we want you to do an audio drama rather than a story in audio. Maybe it was the best one. My favorite remains the Scottish scene. And then the other one that I ran on this show is the one about the lighthouse. The story was called Lighthouse View, but when I ran it on the Rish Outcast, it had a different name. And it's embarrassing that I can't remember that one. But there are certain blocks that I have in my head. And one of them is I can never remember the name of the story where the kids drink the soda and it gives them mind reading abilities. I can never remember the name of that. I want to say In the Mix, because that was going to be the title. Dang, I'm sorry. It was the one where, you know, there was the monster. I want to say the monster might be, or creature feature. Thank you. Come on down, let's show you what you've won. You've won a kayak and a slightly used box of extra large adult diapers. So the story you're about to hear is called Friends in Paradise, and I will talk a tiny bit more about it afterward. It sure feels like I've talked a great deal about it now. Enjoy!
Friends in Paradise. Jessica's family was Hawaii bound. Her big sister Natalie had earned a full ride track and field scholarship to Washington State. And Mom and Daddy were so thrilled, they'd booked a family vacation to Hawaii for the first week of June. Jessica wasn't entirely thrilled. She was 8, and used to being babied and treated like she was an extra special princess in training. But now, Daddy was acting like Natalie was his little girl, showering her with attention, boasting to any who would listen that he was so proud he could just cry. Jessica felt like crying, too. She didn't want to go to Hawaii and watch grown-ups walk around in gross bikinis and sip umbrella drinks that kids weren't supposed to have. Plus, she'd heard it was really hot there, and that the plane ride might be bumpy and last for hours. But Mom told Jessica not to make a stink, and Daddy promised they'd find lots of fun things to do over there, and that she didn't have a choice, being too young to make her own decisions or even get a vote on family activities. They left the house early in the morning, before the sun had even risen, and that didn't help Jessica's disposition one bit. The crickets in the lawn tried their best to cheer Jessica up, singing their loudest. Some of them even came out onto the sidewalk, where Mom shrieked at them and tried to stomp them dead. It didn't do much to change Jessica's mood, but Mom's frightened screams woke up the neighbors, who yelled at her, and that was nice. The flight was long, and there were a couple of bumpy moments, but Jessica slept through most of it, so it could have been a lot worse. Hawaii was hot, but there was a constant breeze from the ocean that kept it from getting too bad, and there were lots of interesting things to see, like grass skirts and colorful birds and waterfalls and spooky tiki masks. Jessica laughed when she saw a huge green butterfly light on the flowers outside the hotel, and watching it, decided she would do her best to make the most of their trip. This was supposed to be paradise, after all. Maybe she could try to have a little fun. But her mother and father wouldn't let her. The only attention they paid her was to tell her when she was doing something wrong. And the rest of the time it was Natalie this, or Natalie that, and she's made us so proud, and this might be our last vacation with Natalie, and our little girl is all grown up and going off to school. No, she wasn't. Jessica was their little girl, and she was being ignored. Hawaii didn't have much to entertain an 8-year-old, it turned out. There was a lot of eating, a lot of walking, a lot of sitting around. Mom kept taking pictures of the water and of the mountains and of everybody with flower necklaces on, but when Jessica asked if she could take some pictures, she was refused. They spent way too long at the beach, but no one would help her build a sandcastle, and she was not allowed to swim in the ocean. They went for a hike, and when she told Daddy that her feet hurt, instead of a piggyback ride, he told her she should have worn tennis shoes instead of sandals. There was a shaved ice vendor on the North Shore that Jessica didn't hate, but the rest of the vacation was deathly dull. They went to the hotel pool area for 3 hours, 3 whole hours, and Jessica had nothing to do but swim in the kiddie pool by herself and sun herself while reading and sleep and play with her Game Boy. Natalie, however, met this brown-skinned boy and spent the whole day with him. He was a hang-gliding instructor there on the island, and he kept putting his hand on Natalie's arms and back, and one time, her bottom. It made Jessica want to look in the other direction, but that's where the sun was, and it kept getting in her eyes. Now Jessica was feeling down in the dumps. The grown-ups said Hawaii was paradise, but there was no one she could play with. Constant irritating sunshine, her Game Boy's battery was almost dead, and anything geared toward a girl her age, Daddy deemed too expensive. The high point of the day came when Jessica saw a big yellow praying mantis moving down a palm tree beside the water fountain. She scooped it up and let it crawl on her arms and shoulders. She could have done that for hours, even though it sort of tickled. It liked her, and she wished she knew what it ate, so she could feed it and take care of it. It wanted that, too. So when it was finally time to go back to their rooms, Jessica took the insect with her. Natalie, who came into the room half an hour later, swaying when she stood still, gasped when she saw the mantis crawling along Jessica's bed. Natalie wasn't afraid of bugs like Mom was, but she was no fan of them either. She went straight to the closet to find a broom to swat the mantis with, but Jessica got in her way.
"I made a new friend, too," she told her, "just like you and that brown-skinned boy." "You're gross," Natalie said, and wouldn't let it go. So Jessica told the mantis to leave.
That night over dinner, Jessica told Daddy about the sign she'd read advertising tours of the local jungle. That's what she wanted to do, to see all the animals and bugs and trees and birds, and imagine that she lived in the jungle, at one with nature.
"And I want to see a volcano, if we can somewhere. Wouldn't that be cool?"
Daddy told her that sounded great, but tomorrow Natalie wanted a hang gliding lesson, and they could go on a tour the next day. Jessica sighed, but at least she could try hang gliding, find out what it was like to soar like a butterfly when...
"Sorry, Jess," Daddy frowned. "Only the big people can do the hang gliding. There's a rule."
Mom patted her hand.
"You and I will be on the ground, watching Daddy and Natalie, cheering them on."
"No!"
Jessica yelled, loud enough that her parents shrank down in their chairs, trying to be invisible.
"Don't you dare make us stink now," Mom growled.
And Jessica didn't shout again. She hated it when she was accused of that. Dad said they'd have plenty of fun the day after, on their jungle tour safari, but first, Natalie got to have her day. Mom promised they'd get another shaved ice, maybe in a souvenir glass. But that didn't matter. Now Jessica was both lonely and angry as well. The next day, Jessica did try her best to be cheerful. The family went to a store so Natalie could buy a cute outfit, and then they took a big golf cart thing to the top of a very high hill, overlooking a long stretch of shore and about 1,000,000 miles of ocean. Jessica watched a colony of very friendly ants while Daddy and Natalie, the big people, got their assigned gliders and pilots, or whatever you called them. Big surprise, Natalie's instructor was the brown-skinned boy who liked to put his hand on her. There would be lots of chances for that up in the air together, apparently. They were told it would be a long wait before their turn, so Jessica and her mother had to go back down the hill where they'd started to watch it all from there. Jessica bid the ants farewell, sighing. Bugs were so easy to please, so happy to see Jessica wherever she went, that she wished others could understand, could see how special a girl she was. But Mom said insects made her skin crawl, and besides, she couldn't stop talking about hula dancing and putting on grass skirts and maybe making everyone get lessons that evening or the next. She had bought a red flower and put it in her hair like one of those phones that sits on your ear, and wanted to buy more for her daughters, and wanted to take pictures, but the batteries had run down and she had left the new ones back in the hotel room.
"Damn rechargeable batteries cost 5 times what regular ones do, yet they last half as long,"
Mom was complaining, while Jessica wandered away. Her spirits lightened when her praying mantis friend found her again. It had brought a companion, a fat green female, and both of them played tag on the girl's arms as they waited for Daddy and Natalie to jump off the mountain.
"Jessica, what are you doing?"
Mom was standing next to her, looking away from the hill and the colorful gliders for once. One of the mantises flew away, suddenly afraid.
"Playing. I'm making friends." "Oh my God, they're on you!"
Mom began to shriek. She'd reacted badly to Jessica's bug friends back home, but never like this. She was now shaking and twitching, as if they were on her instead of her daughter, and biting her instead of playing a game.
"Get rid of that! It's dirty!"
"No, she isn't.
You don't know where it's been. What if it's poisonous? What if it stings you?"
Jessica tried reasoning with her mother.
Mantis's bite, Mom. Bees sting. Get rid of it, Jessica!
She shouted, so involved with her daughter that she'd missed Daddy running off the cliff in his yellow glider. Jessica bid the mantises farewell, seething with anger. Mom continued to shake and make a fuss, only calming a little when Natalie, her good, ladylike daughter, started down the cliff, her red glider looking like a kite, it was so high up. Jessica glanced at a vendor's flowers a few feet away, where there were flowers. Natalie whooped with delight as they soared through the air. Chino, the instructor, laughed and said, "Pretty sick, huh?" Indeed it was. This was the greatest feeling imaginable. So high, so free. Something buzzed in Natalie's ear. She shook her head, and a bee flitted in front of her nose. The buzzing beside her continued. A wasp lit on the crossbar she was gripping in front of her. It was joined by a pair of bees, a honeybee, and a big yellow bumblebee. Chino yelped, and the glider shuddered.
"I know! There's a..."
Then Natalie yelped too as she felt something sting the back of her neck. The entire glider shook. All around them, bees and wasps and hornets and yellow jackets swarmed. Natalie screamed. Back on the shore, Mom forgot her anger and revulsion as she saw the glider's erratic movements. They couldn't see what was happening up there, but something was definitely wrong. Jessica, too, watched the glider veer and twist, not entirely sure what she was witnessing. And then it took a sharp turn and dropped toward the beach. The doctor said Natalie had been lucky. She and the instructor could have been killed. But Natalie was fortunate enough to have only a few cracked ribs and a compound fracture of her left leg, along with half a dozen insect stings. Upon hearing the prognosis, Mom calmed down. But it was Daddy's turn to become hysterical. There was no way Natalie'd keep her track scholarship now.
"But Daddy,"
Jessica said, trying to talk like the grown-ups did.
"Before you were happy she broke her leg."
He looked at her with such horror, you'd have thought she put ladybugs in her hair again.
"What?"
But then realization seeped into his eyes.
"Yes, rather than dying, yes. But this is still a tragedy."
"It's like some kind of nightmare,"
Natalie mumbled.
"Oh, sweetheart,"
Daddy said, his voice hitching in his throat.
"My baby's beautiful legs," he cried,
actually shedding tears. What a creepy thing for a father to say. Chino, the hang gliding instructor, had hurt his tailbone and ankle, and to his chagrin, his wife met him at the hospital, upset and very pregnant. Mom seemed bothered by this, but Jessica had no idea why any of it mattered. Mom had spent an hour on her cell phone. She knew a specialist, the one who fixed Uncle Alex's back, and he would make an emergency appointment for Monday. They'd all been booked on the first flight home the next day. The specialist would look at Natalie's leg and see if he couldn't perform a miracle. She just had to relax and rest until they could get back stateside and get to work on making her good as new.
"But what about the jungle tour, Mom?"
Jessica asked.
"The what?" "Daddy and me are going on a jungle tour tomorrow." "Oh, no, honey, not anymore. We're flying back tomorrow." "But..."
She thought quickly and came up with something her mother might find acceptable.
"Maybe you and Natalie could go home tomorrow, and me and Daddy could go home the next day." "What are you talking about? This is a family, Jessica. Stop being so selfish."
We're going to the luau tonight. Then the whole family is flying back tomorrow morning. All of us."
Now it was Jessica's turn to cry. The sun was going down, and the family was all together now, at that feast, celebration with the Hawaiian name. Everyone around them was laughing, swaying to the music, drinking from cups made to look like pineapples and coconuts, talking too loud, and stuffing their faces. Natalie was very quiet. She was sitting in a motorized wheelchair, which seemed pretty cool to Jessica, but alternated between staring into space like a zombie and crying like a baby in a high chair. Daddy said it was the painkillers, but he didn't look much better. On one side of her were drummers and dancing girls, and a muscular dude who juggled fire on the other. But Jessica didn't care. She was angry, and nothing could take her mind off it, even when a great big moth, half a foot wide, lit on her shoulder and kissed her with its long, curly tongue. She appreciated the gesture, but sighed anyway. They were cutting their vacation short, going home without doing any of what Jessica had looked forward to.
"Jessica and Marion Flickinger, what the hell are you doing?"
she heard a woman's voice ask, revulsion and alcohol slurring her words.
"Leave me alone, Mom,"
Jessica growled.
"What did you say?"
Jessica repeated herself, her teeth grinding together.
"Leave me alone and enjoy the boo-ow."
The moth flew away, recognizing Jessica's increasingly foul mood.
"Luau,"
Mom corrected, and started back toward the table with the dead pig and pineapples on it. A moth, much smaller and scary to nobody, was flitting around the burning torch there, and Mom shooed it away with yet another overdramatic cry of disgust.
"Fine,"
Jessica said, standing up straighter. She made tight fists at her side, doing her best to break the skin of her palms with her fingernails.
"Shoo them all away."
She took a deep breath and let it out slowly between the spaces in her teeth. The people heard it first, like a wind through long, dry grass. But in a moment, all could see. Insects came streaming from the trees, from under rocks, from flowers and gardens and trash cans and cracks in the asphalt. Scores of them, hundreds, thousands, and still more came. Tourists screamed. A fat guy started to shout words that might have been a prayer. One woman vomited. Several of the bravest creatures circled around Jessica, skittering by her shoes and in her shadow, but not daring to touch her. They scampered over one another, dancing, singing, snapping and flapping, vying for her attention. Pill bugs formed a tight circle, like a circus train, and began to go round and round, trying their best to cheer the girl up.
"Thanks for trying,"
she said, but she was blue as a morpho butterfly. Something crashed nearby. People were trying to get the upper hand on the insects, stamping at the cockroaches and crickets and beetles and batting at dragonflies and cicadas and June bugs and hornets. Mosquitoes covered the arms of the native drummers. Gnats swarmed the dancing girls' eyes and mouths. A tidal wave of ants, red, brown, and black, poured over the tables, completely masking every inch of the food, on their way to overrun the guests' feet and legs. Natalie howled as stink bugs sprayed her hair.
"Looks like I'm making a stink again,"
Jessica said as the praying mantis from before lit on her shoulder. It was a very funny joke, but Jessica's eyes still brimmed with tears. They spilled over and ran down her cheeks.
"Don't be sad, Princess Jessica,"
they seemed to say.
"Just tell us what we can do."
She looked down at the throng of six-legged followers, worshipful and enthusiastic. She understood exactly how they felt. She leaned in, addressing them.
"Go say hi to my mother."
And they did. People blocks away heard the commotion and the screaming as the woman was engulfed by a wriggling, pulsating mass of life. Daddy was pinched again and again by earwigs, and Natalie began to dance in her wheelchair as caterpillars, grubs, and aphids scampered over her. A long brown centipede slithered down her blouse, not wanting its insect cousins to hog all the fun. The little girl looked from victim to victim as they succumbed to the onslaught of nature, shrieking, dropping, then falling still. Then something new caught her eye. Fireflies whirled and gambolled in front of Jessica, blinking as fast as they could, trying frenetically to please her. There weren't a lot of them on the island, but finally, they were rewarded with a smile. Jessica shook her head. This was paradise, after all, and it was hard to stay mad. Not with friends like this. The end.
Okay, so that was Friends in Paradise. And I was hesitant to share that with you because I... What? Let's go ahead, kids. Go ahead and say it.
It's not a great story.
Oh, they get cuter every time, don't they? It's not. I did not win the contest with this first story, and rightly so. But, you know, I don't know that the story deserves to be forgotten forever. The elements that they gave. Okay, so, as I said, that they had three elements that they, I feel like they pulled out of a hat or something like that, that you had to include in the story. What was the theme and what were the elements?
Kiss my grits. You could kiss my grits. I want you to kiss my grits.
The theme was phobias. And my trio of requisites were entomophobia, hang glider, and luau.
Okay, thank you. Slightly older Rich Outfield. So I had to incorporate those three into the story, and then I also it had to have a word limit, and it was always challenging that aspect of this contest because I overwrite. You know, I'm not even going to say that I overwrite, but it's just like there are certain ideas that lend themselves to longer stories, and even when I have a short story idea, it's shocking how fast the time goes or how quickly the word count is exceeded. And I found the second time I did it when I had to do the Haunted White House story that basically I just had to cut out any personality, anything that wasn't directly involved in the story, which meant character development and dialogue had to go. And I don't know which story is worse, Friends in Paradise or White House Tour. I don't hate either of the stories, but when I lost on both of them, it wasn't like, oh, damn, I got ripped off. I got robbed. And you never know what's going to appeal to the judges anyway. Oh, gosh, that makes me want to tell a story. I'll tell that story in just a minute. So what you just heard was a 2018 reading of that story. Because the original reading from, let's say it was 2011 or 2010, something like that, no longer exists. And I remember being frustrated that very first time because I felt like the story was really, really short and I recorded it. And then when I went to edit it, it was too long. And how do you cut out 3 minutes from a 13-minute story without losing a lot? And I tried a bunch of different tricks and most of it was just frustrating. And so what you heard just now is the story as it's meant to be told, with regular pacing and dialogue. Originally, back then, maybe it was 2010, I had my niece voice the little girl because she was about 10 at the time. She just turned 18 last week, and I thought about asking her if she would voice the little girl again, you know, for this version of the story, and ask her, do you even remember doing the first one? But I didn't. One day I really would like to have her narrate a whole story for me, because she's got a good voice. She's smart. She's not stilted or really, really wooden. She seems okay to perform for me, or at least she did when she was younger. She also voiced the little girl in Little Miss Fortune. And maybe it was Miss Fortune, I don't know. And it was more of a challenge for her as like a 15-year-old or whatever to sound like a little girl than it was for as a 10-year-old to sound like a little girl, because, you know, she didn't have to do anything with her voice. I don't know if the story would have a better impact, or it would be better in audio if my niece voiced the character, if I had, you know, more than one voice included. But as you know, it's just more work. You compound the work with each voice that you add. And I mean, we're all friends here. There have been times when Big and I have recorded a story for the Doonstief, and then we get the full cast lines in, and some of them aren't nearly as good as what we did. The person that voiced it didn't know the context. The person that voiced it is not a professional actor. The person that voiced it didn't have the right intonation, or, you know, something like that. And so you have the plus and minus of the full cast. I've talked a lot on this show about writing stories for contests. And the thing that I always go back to over and over again is that when you write a story for a contest, it's a story that you wouldn't normally have written. And I like that a lot. I also like that you can't predict whether it's going to be a good story or a bad story. It's something that you write sort of by the skin of your teeth. And if you get lucky, you write something really good. And if you're not lucky, well, it's not so good. But the goal for me has never been to win the contest. The goal for me has always been to write the best story that I can, or to find the impetus to write a new story. And so for me, the 5 years that I entered that contest, they were all successes, because I set out to write a story and I managed to do it, and I got it in within the deadline. And it aired on their show. I don't know. It's something that I'm sharing with you because I was recently producing an audio collection. And I talked about it in the telephone episode. You know, the telephone is ringing. And it just kept coming up short. I wanted it to be approximately the same length as the other two collections that I had put out. And so I just had to keep adding stories that I had in audio. And ultimately I ran out. And I thought, well, okay, what can I record to get this thing up to the length of the other two? And I looked through a bunch of stories that I had and recorded a couple of them. And one of the ones that I saw was Friends in Paradise. And I thought, huh, I guess I could do that. It didn't make it into the collection, but I felt motivated to record something. And so I chose to do this. I've done it a couple of times here at the end of the year. I just grabbed something and recorded it and said, you know, as a reward, when I'm done recording it, I can go to sleep. And it just, you know, whatever gets you off your butt, whatever gets you there to, you know, be motivated, to not be lazy, to work just a little bit harder, those are good things. And so that's what happened with this. And now the story exists again in a shareable format, whereas it didn't before, because I had to re-record it. And so there you go. Anyhow, I was reminded of something a couple of minutes ago, and I guess I'll talk about that. But first, no, it's not a great story. And the main character, the little girl, is kind of a brat. I'm not sure that there's much artistry or anything in this story. But as I was reading it, you know, with the distance of years between writing it and recording it, I found it kind of interesting that I didn't spell out that she had always had a rapport with insects, that she could communicate with bugs. I didn't explain that right out of the gate, that I put little breadcrumbs for you to figure that out. And I like that. I like that she has her point of view, and it's narrow and solipsistic and spoiled and childlike. I like that. And then the ending is kind of nasty. And I like that, too. Like I said, you know, the story is a success because I wrote it. And it's a shame that I had to win that dang contest because they said I couldn't enter it anymore. And who knows what their themes and keywords have been in the years since and what stories I might have created for them. Anyhow, a moment ago I mentioned that, you know, you never know what's going to appeal to the judges. You never know what's going to drive them away or impress them. And it made me think of, I had an interesting experience this year where I got to be a judge for a competition of short plays. They were all in the horror genre and they were short performances, mostly in audio, although it was performed on a stage in front of an audience. And I got to be a judge at this competition, and there were several of us as judges, and I wish that I had the opportunity or taken the opportunity to talk to the other judges to find out what they liked and what they didn't like. Let me see if I can sort of sum up what the five plays were about. The first was that there were two little girls alone in their father's house, and there was a room that was forbidden to them. Their mother had died and they were at home alone, and the one girl dares to go into the forbidden room, and they find basically a spirit that claims to be their dead mother, and that spirit wants them to do something for her, and it becomes fairly clear early on that the spirit is not as benign as she appears and may not indeed even be that of their dead mother. I thought that that was really interesting. The second one was, there is a young woman who gets migraines. And the migraine, one day, one particularly terrible day, when she has to suffer her no good boyfriend, her terrible boss, and, you know, a headache, the migraine starts to talk to her. And the migraine has a voice and a distinct personality. And turns out that, oh yes, she's been going to a doctor who seems to not believe that she's in as much pain as she claims that she is. And the migraine sort of hints that it's this woman's fault. And perhaps it would be better if the migraine killed her and moved on to somebody else. There was a story of two roommates, a guy and a girl, and the guy starts having insomnia. He can't go to sleep. And the roommate recommends that he checks out one of those ASMR videos on YouTube, and she sends him the link to, I think, two of these relaxing videos, and he clicks on the first two links, and they don't really do anything for him, but then the third link is a mermaid who's telling him how to relax, and she didn't send him this third link. It just happened to be on the email, and he actually is able to go to sleep. But the roommate says, oh my gosh, you were so loud last night with your tossing, and and screaming, you know, I pounded on the door a couple of times, but you never even responded. And he's like, what? No, I slept like a baby. What do you mean screaming? That one was really scary, I thought. Then there was a play where the police have come to investigate a happening at a retirement home. And the nurses are telling the story of this woman that came to their nursing home after the home that she had previously been in burned down. And they brought this woman there, and she kept saying that she could hear her son trying to get in through the maintenance door. And she's like, won't you let my son in? Please, he's banging, he's calling for me. And they all are pretty sure that she's crazy, because of course they don't hear anything. And that maintenance door doesn't open. It's been jammed shut for years. Just it doesn't work. And that one was disturbing because of the performances. The very convincing mad woman, and then the reactions of the staff as they discover, you know, that she seems to hear something they don't hear. And then the last play was, there are these two scientists with sort of Germanic accents, and they have been tasked to create some kind of animal for their master. They keep trying to make the changes that the master requires, and these animals all die horribly. And at the point that we're catching up with them, they have yet another test animal that they're working on, and it's quite brutal what they're doing with it. But they never spell out where they are, who their master is, or what kind of thing they're trying to perform. And it wasn't until close to the end of the play that I finally realized where they were and what this animal was. Because they would say, you know, subject 205 has shown this and that, and they never specified what kind of animal it was, whether it had a name or anything like that. And of course it wouldn't have had a name when you've been mutilating this many animals. It was really unpleasant and really disturbing. And then at the end, it was fun to hear the reaction of the audience as they got the punchline, the who the master is and what they've been working on all this time. I was taking like little notes on each one of these plays, and I didn't know if they would give us a few minutes to talk to the other judges to decide, you know, I liked this and I liked that. And they didn't. They just said, you know, tally up your scores and then give an extra half point to the one of the five that you felt was the best to put it over the top. And I chose the ASMR video one. I felt like it worked the best for sound, because these were sort of supposed to be audio dramas, and then it worked for how disturbing it was. And it also had some humor, and I didn't get to talk to the other judges afterward, find out which ones they liked. I did talk to a couple of the audience members, and one of them really dug the one with the two girls and their dead mother. One of them really, really liked the migraine story. But to my surprise, the ASMR video play was the winner. And so it was not just me that gave it the highest score, I guess. We never found out like the exact numbers or anything like that. But I found that really interesting, and I would love to have talked to them, to the other judges, about what did you look for, and did the performances of the actors have anything to do with the score that you gave? Did the tone, how scary it was, or funny it was, or sick it was, have anything to do with the score that you gave? That sort of stuff is interesting to me, and it was answers that I never got. I'm not really sure why I'm telling you this. Oh, well, it was just such an interesting experience being a judge rather than a participant. And of course, I have experience as, you know, being one of the editors of the Doonstief and reading submissions for years. You know, just trying to decide what should make it and what shouldn't. And I still do that to a limited extent. Every once in a while reading a story and saying, oh yeah, we should buy this for the podcast. But yes, as I was saying, it would have been enlightening to sit down with the other judges and talk about what did you like and what resonated with you and why did you vote for what you voted for. I only know what worked for me. And I thought about that, about, you know, my experience with writing audio drama and whether I could enter that same contest, you know, that kind of thing, whether I could write I mean, it's essentially an audio drama, but it's being performed live in front of an audience by actors. They're not in costume, they're not memorized, they're just reading. It's a live reading, I suppose. And I thought about this idea that I had about these pioneers that are coming through the Colorado Rockies and something being out there in the snow that's picking them off one by one. And I felt like, you know, the best possible venue for that idea is not a novel and not even a movie script that's, you know, 2 hours long or 90 minutes long, but something like this. You know, it's 15 minutes. It's a short audio drama. And that way, I did some research on it and I just realized, oh my gosh, this is going to be so much work to make it historically accurate. But if you're doing a 15-minute version of that story, then none of that stuff matters. All the detail and all of the research. I felt like, yeah, if I could submit this idea as an audio drama, maybe I could have my play up there performed next year. Anyhow, it was just something in my mind, something that I thought about. And, you know, it's always cool to have ideas and plans and, you know, the thing I do after this is this, and the thing that I do after that. If you run out of projects, run out of things that you would like to do, would like to accomplish, then why get up in the morning? Then why continue at all? And so the fact that I always have so many ideas and write so few of them, as terrible as that feels to me, maybe it's not so terrible. Maybe it's good and positive because it means that there will be something to do 6 months from now. There will be something to do next year and the year after. I don't know, that seems pretty positive to me. And once again, it's a shame that I don't have the Horror Addicts Masters of the Macabre, that's what it was called, contest to enter anymore, because it just would have been fun to do this again and again and look forward to it every year. But I do have a podcast, and you've listened to it. And there will be another podcast after this one and another one after that. And there's something hopeful about that as well. In my mind, if you would like to support me through Patreon, you can donate $1 an episode. You can donate $2 an episode. And every little bit helps. Every patron helps. And, you know, if you can't do that sort of thing, just friend me on Facebook. Send me a message that you liked something that you... You know, one thing that has always been really helpful to me is when somebody says, oh, hey, you did an episode where you said this, or you had an idea for this. Did that ever go anywhere? There have been stories that I've picked up and finished after abandoning them for years because somebody said, hey, did you ever finish that story about the, you know, the text messages from beyond the grave? That sort of thing is super helpful. It's just helpful to know that somebody is interested. But hey, you listened all the way to the end of the episode, and that makes you special. Makes me feel special. Let's be special together. I have been Rish Outfield, and try not to squash a bug today, because one day they may squash you. Yeah, sorry. Good night.
The music in this episode was created by Kevin MacLeod, whose shenanigans can be found over at incompetech.com. The Rish Outcast really should not exist. But since it does, I suppose the best that can be said of it is that it was produced under a Creative Commons 3.0 license. Of course, that's a little bit like noticing the piranhas eating you of a very attractive coloring.
Oh, so it's a new year, 2019, right? And at the end of 2018, I was really frustrated because Audible kept rejecting my audiobooks because they were too quiet. And I had one of you, Rob, commented that the Rish Outcast is always the quietest show in his feed. So I was just like, okay, so it's definitely my recordings that are plaguing me in here. And so from that moment on, from when he said that, I started recording things louder. And so the story that you just heard and the recording right now should be louder than they were last year.
They'd booked a family vacation to Hawaii for the first week of June. And belched. It was great.